moment, and then he says he'll come into it eventually, when Archie goes. Annie raised an eyebrow. That's a generous gift. Archie has no family.
No, said Annie,
nor does he.
But now he does, you see.
Chapter 27. In 1951, Ilse received an invitation to a wedding in a village in Oxfordshire. One of the British majors, the one who had taught Ubi English, had left the army and taken a job as a teacher in a boys' boarding school. He was marrying the daughter of the local doctor and had sent an invitation to Ilse, with whom he had maintained a correspondence since leaving Germany. Ubi had also been invited, but was unable to make the journey as somebody had to stay behind to look after the hotel. He was uncomfortable, too, about going to England. "They might not want to see us just yet," he said. Ilse laughed at him. "But they've invited us," she pointed out. "I don't mean them, the Major. I don't mean him. I mean people in general. What if we turned a corner and there was Winston Churchill?" This brought more laughter. "Mr. Churchill would be very polite. I'm sure he would say, 'Guten Tag.'" It was not a journey undertaken lightly. In Germany, things were returning to normal, step by cautious step. In England, the Festival of Britain, an ambitious official effort to persuade people to address the future with optimism, was underway, but people still felt bruised by years of privation. Travel was still a luxury for both nations. Ilse bought a new dress for the wedding and made the journey by train to Calais, where she boarded the ferry to Dover. The following day she arrived at her small hotel in the village where the wedding was due to take place. At the wedding, although the major and his bride were polite and welcoming, the other guests seemed standoffish. She sensed that she was being pointed out as the German guest, the subject of whispers and sideways glances. She had a day in hand after the wedding, before she had to get back to Dover for her return ferry. She had with her the diary in which she had written Val's address, and she asked the woman who kept the hotel whether it would be possible to get there and back in a day. She and Val had exchanged letters since that first letter of sympathy, writing to one another every 2 or 3 months, as pen friends. Val had said that if Ilse ever came to England, she should come to see her, and Ilse had reciprocated. Neither had imagined that either would ever take up the invitation, but now Ilse found herself feeling a certain curiosity about her unmet friend. The hotel keeper told her that it would not be a complicated trip. There was a bus that stopped at the edge of the village. This would take her all the way to a town near Val's village. She could go from there by taxi. She sent a telegram to warn Val of her arrival, not knowing whether it would reach her in time. She arrived at the post office, to which she had addressed her letters to Val. Annie greeted her warmly. The telegram had been received a few hours earlier. "I know all about you," she said. "I'll telephone Val and tell her you're here." Val collected her in the farm van and took her back to meet Willie and Tommy. The two women's conversation was stilted at first, but after a while it became more relaxed.
"Our husbands had a very good friendship," said Ilse.
Val sighed. "War is unnatural. Friendship isn't."
"Yes," said Ilse. "We women know that."
Val thought, "We had to fight, though, and it was because of you." But she stopped herself, because she knew that forgiveness demanded that such thoughts be put to one side. Ilse caught her bus back to her hotel late that afternoon. She felt herself becoming emotional when she said goodbye to Val and to Tommy.
"You will continue to write, won't you?"
she asked Val as they stood at the bus stop.
"Of course," promised Val.
"It will be much easier now that you've seen the farm and we've met. Much easier." The bus took Ilse off, its tired engine spluttering as it drew away from the stop. She waved to Val and Tommy through the window beside her seat. The window was dirty, and somebody had traced a message on its surface. "Harry loves Geraldine. True." She raised a finger and wrote underneath it, "I have a true friend." It was an odd, childish thing to do. Harry, who had written the other message, was probably 16 or 17, unless, of course, it was Geraldine who had written those words, in the hope that what she said was true was really the truth.
everything changed. A great wave of prosperity washed over Germany as the pinched, hungry years of the 50s gave way to a decade of plenty. In Britain, crisis followed crisis as the world folded in over a country that was exhausted to its very bones. The youthful vanquished, rebuilt and prospered. The aged victors looked on in puzzlement as their lucrative empire crumbled. Ilse sold the inn to a wealthy businessman who wanted it for a brother-in-law who had managed to escape from the east. Ubi moved the motodrome to a site in the countryside. There was a house attached to the field in which the motodrome now stood, and that became their home. A young mechanic, an enthusiastic motorcyclist, was taken on as the principal rider, and he brought with him a friend who joined him on the wall. A new road had been built nearby, an arterial highway that brought a stream of visitors to the attraction. Ubi said to Ilse, "Did you ever imagine this? Ever?" They were sitting outside the motodrome. Inside, the roar of motorcycles and the rattle of the wooden planks that made up the wall reached a climax. The cheers of the crowd became raucous applause. "They're enjoying it," said Ilse. And then, "I would never have believed we would be doing this. Running a motodrome?" "Yes, and everything else. The war, Klaus, us." He smiled at her and touched her hand gently. "Very few people imagine their own future accurately, and then they're often pleasantly surprised." Ubi occasionally rode the motodrome himself, but he knew that Ilse did not like it, and he was careful in the routines he performed. The two young men had no such scruples, and shot up and down, their paths intersecting with a bravado that made the spectators gasp with pleasure. "If you kill yourselves," Ilse warned them, "you'll have only yourselves to blame." "No, we won't," said the younger of the two. "We won't be around to blame anybody."
"Don't tempt Providence," Ilse retorted.
Ubi taught Ilse how to ride a motorcycle, not on the motodrome, but sedately on the roads. She enjoyed this, and he bought her a modest machine of their own. He acquired for himself a large Ducati, painted red and with gleaming chrome. They rode away together at weekends, leaving Klaus with Ilse's aunt, and putting the young men in charge of the motodrome. They rode down to Munich and to Regensburg. They joined a motorcycle club. Ubi became president, while Ilse was elected treasurer. Klaus watched. He said, "I'm going to get a motorcycle too one day."
"One day," said Ubi, noncommittally.
A month later, Ilse wrote to Val,
"How do you stop a boy doing dangerous things?
One of the young men who works on our motodrome has somehow got hold of a miniature motorcycle, and I caught him putting Klaus on it."
"You can't stop them," came the reply. "Boys do foolish things. It's what they do."
Things went well for Val and Willie, too. They had moved from the post office to live on the farm, and Willie had helped Archie get the stockman's cottage into order. They had installed a bath and a new range in the farmhouse kitchen, and she had sewn new curtains from material that Annie had obtained from somewhere. Annie was always getting hold of material somehow or other. It had become a bit of a family joke. On good days, Archie would come up from his cottage and sit with her in the kitchen, where it was warmest, to look out on the fields that he could no longer work in because of his arthritis. He knew every inch of the land, she thought, every inch. He would have cared for it year after year, and his father would have done exactly the same, without complaint, without questioning their destiny to nurture this little bit of England for their lifetime, and then hand it over to the next generation to do the same. Tommy would not do that, though, and they would have to find somebody else to run the farm in due course. Val knew, even when he was still a small boy, that he would do something different, that he would be an engineer. He was fascinated by machinery and how things worked. When he was 7, she bought him a book called The Boy's Book of How Everything Works, which contained cutaway illustrations of the insides of ships and locomotives and even planes. It was all laid out there in coloured diagrams, and he had pored over these, often with Willie, discussing the mechanisms that made these things work. Willie was learning every bit as much as Tommy was, she felt. She overheard a conversation about jet propulsion.
"Where does the air go, Tommy?"
Tommy had taken Willie's finger and moved it to a place on the drawing.
It goes in there, you see? There. And then it gets heated up, and it comes out there with a whoosh.
Which makes the plane go forward?
Yes, Willie. Forward, you see?
She smiled at the memory. It did not matter to Tommy that Willie was slow to take new things in. The boy seemed to take that in his stride, and even took pleasure in explaining something that Willie was not immediately grasping. And later, when Tommy was old enough to understand, she explained to him about how Willie had agreed to look after them, and how he worked hard to make up for the fact that they had lost his real father.
"He flew an aeroplane," she said. "Your first dad. He was a pilot."
"In the war?"
"Yes, in the war, as I've told you,
lots of times, remember?"
"He was American."
She nodded.
"Yes, he was American, Tommy. He came from a place called Muncie, Indiana. He used to tell me about it."
"But you never went there." She took a moment to answer. That was an unfulfilled promise, in a way, to Mike. Perhaps she would honor it some day, and she would take Tommy and show him the place where his father came from.
"No, I didn't go there myself. But maybe, one day, you and I..."
"Yes, yes, please.
We'll try."
She took a deep breath. She could so easily cry, but children became very anxious if an adult cried without reason, or without a reason they could comprehend.
"There's another thing about your first dad. He was a very brave man. Some day you'll understand just how brave he was, but for now, just believe me. He was a brave man."
He was watching her.
"And here's yet another thing," she said. "We had a dog, you know. We had a dog with a funny name."
"How funny?"
"He was called Peter Woodhouse. And you know what? He sometimes went off with your dad in his plane. He was what they called a mascot."
"What's that?"
"It's an animal that people sometimes have to keep them company. They sometimes think that a mascot brings good luck." She paused.
"Which I think might just be true."
He looked unconvinced.
"How could an animal bring you good luck?"
She shrugged.
"I don't quite know. But they do, I think. They can help when you're in danger. That's what those pilots thought."
"My dad thought that?"
"I think he probably did."
The boy looked thoughtful.
"Do animals go to heaven when they die? Like people?"
One could answer from one's head, she thought, or from one's heart.
"I don't know," she replied.
She touched him lightly on his head, on the sandy-coloured hair that came from his father.
"But perhaps, just perhaps, they do.
Perhaps dogs, for instance, go to a special heaven for dogs.
With lots of bones for them to chew."
She laughed.
"Yes, with lots of bones and plenty of smells. Dogs would love that, don't you think? Plenty of smells for them to sniff at.
And rabbits to chase."
"Yes, lots of rabbits. The rabbits that had been bad on Earth, maybe. They'd be sent to dog heaven, which wouldn't be so much fun for them. The good rabbits would go to a place where they chase the dogs."
"Was Peter Woodhouse a good dog?"
"A very good dog."
"So he'll be in dog heaven?"
She smiled.
"Yes, I expect he will. Doing his job, which is to watch over us, I think. You and me. He'll be watching."
Part 5. Afterwards. Chapter 28. In June 1981, in the southern German city of Regensburg, a meeting took place in the office of a quietly spoken lawyer. The lawyer, Franz Huber, was careful, almost fussy in his manner. This suited his practice, which was mostly concerned with domestic affairs, family property, wills and the like, and with the day-to-day issues of small businesses. He had a talent for persuading clients to adopt what he described as the wise and cautious solution to the complexities of their affairs. He was fond of saying, "Nobody has ever regretted erring on the side of caution."
an observation that, under any scrutiny, would soon be shown to be false, but Herr Huber had little interest in missed opportunities.
"Frau Dietrich," he said, tapping his pencil discreetly on the edge of his desk, "this English lady, may I ask, have you known her for a long time?"
On the other side of his desk, Ilse tried to conceal her irritation. She had never liked Herr Huber, even if Ubi had thought highly of him. They had had few professional dealings. There was not much call for that, but Ubi knew him from the swimming club they had both been members of, and had mentioned him from time to time. She knew that Ubi had placed his affairs in Herr Huber's hands, and she knew that this would mean she would have to deal with him in due course.
"Many years," she replied.
"And your husband knew her too?"
She nodded.
"It was through him that we met, you see, a long time ago. My husband knew her husband, and that was how I knew about her. It was one of those strange things that happened in those days. People were brought together in odd ways."
He raised an eyebrow.
"I don't wish to pry," he said, "but here you are, proposing to give your two employees a half-share in the business, while you and this English lady go off on this trip you've been talking about."
She kept her temper. There was no point in antagonizing the man.
"She has a name, Herr Huber. Mrs. Rogers. I call her Val. The English are less formal than we are, as I'm sure you're aware."
"Yes, of course. Mrs. Rogers, forgive me. Well, I really want to make sure that this Mrs. Rogers isn't persuading you to take this step. The late Herr Dietrich, your husband, of course, would not have wished you to divest yourself at this stage of the business he had built up. She is a newcomer, so to speak."
She shook her head.
"She is not a newcomer, Herr Huber. She has been coming to see me for years now, and we're only going away for a couple of months."
And there was more.
"These two employees have been with me for 6 years now. They have been very loyal."
The pace of the pencil tapping increased until he noticed that her eyes were fixed on it, and he rapidly put it away.
"You are going off on your motorcycles," he muttered.
"On one motorcycle," she corrected him.
"I have a great deal of experience with motorcycles, as you can imagine. Herr Dietrich and I used to go on our holidays that way. We rode all the way down to Italy. A large motorcycle is very comfortable for the pillion passenger, just as it is for the driver."
She saw a thin smile play about his lips. She did not have to justify herself to him, she thought.
"The important thing is to be happy."
Who had said that?
Oh, hundreds of people, she thought. Hundreds and hundreds of people through the ages, and all of them right. Because it was the important thing, the most important thing of all, when you came to think about it.
She glanced out of the window. There was a large tree directly outside, and its branches were moving in the breeze. In the distance, a hillside rose up to meet the pale summer sky. Perhaps it would be best to explain to him what had happened. This dry, essentially humorless lawyer might just understand if she explained the history.
"My husband served in the war," she said.
She held his gaze. There was a flicker, just a flicker.
"And in the course of his service, he met an American airman.
His face was immobile. He doesn't wish to be reminded." He spoke.
"I see. An American airman."
"Yes. And then they met later on, during the Berlin airlift."
Herr Huber relaxed. That was a different narrative, with a different set of victims.
"The American was married to an Englishwoman.
He met her when he was stationed in England during the war. She came with him when he was based here in Germany. They were down in Wiesbaden, although he had to fly all over. He was one of the pilots who went into Berlin." He was comfortable now.
"That was so very important," he said.
"If they hadn't done that," he shrugged, "the Soviets would have taken everything eventually. I doubt if we would be here today having this conversation. We have a lot to thank the Americans for."
Ilse said, "You are right. It was very important. And they were brave men."
"Of course they were."
"He was one of the ones who was killed," she continued. "It was towards the end of the blockade, just days before, I think.
They had to fly in all sorts of conditions. I don't think it was anybody's fault. Something went wrong and his plane went down. We were in touch with his widow afterwards.
Wartime friendships, said Herr Huber. They can be very strong, I think.
His widow went back to England, to her people.
Herr Huber nodded.
It's always best, he said, if you can go home. That's the best thing to do, always.
He paused.
And then?
I wrote to her. My husband, you see, was not a very good correspondent. Men aren't, you see, and wives have to...
She trailed away. He was looking reproachful.
Some men, Frau Dietrich, some men, not all of them.
She inclined her head.
Yes, you're right, not all men.
But as I was saying, we wrote to one another over the years.
Every year there was a Christmas card, that sort of thing.
And a letter as well. She married again. She lived on a farm over there. I went to see her, and then she came over to Germany every other year to stay with us.
The lawyer inclined his head.
I understand, Frau Dietrich,
and it is not for me to interfere in your plans.
No, she said, it is not.
Dust, white dust of the sort that for its fineness took time to settle, was thrown up in a small cloud behind them as Ilse applied the brakes of the motorbike. It was hot, and when she switched off the engine, the air was filled with the screech of cicadas. Someone in the distance was cutting wood with a buzz saw, the old branches of a vine, perhaps, because there were vineyards stretched out across the slopes of the hillsides here. She silently coasted the heavy bike into the shade thrown by a sculpted birch tree. These trees formed a regimented line along the edge of the village. Below them the land fell away sharply to the plains below. On the other side of the road was the village, a cluster of buildings ascending to a tangle of woods, above which the sky, pale in this heat, was dizzying in its emptiness. The village had no proper piazza, the public space being the area in front of the shops and houses that made up the main street. At the end of this one-sided street was a church, its open door looking to all intents and purposes like the mouth of a cave. At least it would be cool in there, with the rock as its floor, and the shelter it provided from the relentless sun. They stretched when they dismounted, taking off their helmets and putting them on the seats of the motorcycle before they stretched their legs. They had been riding non-stop since Florence that morning. The day before they had ridden all the way from Milan, and both had felt the aches that came with such a long spell on the road. Now, though, there was lunch to look forward to, and the village at least boasted a proper restaurant with umbrellas outside and a table of old men sitting smoking and nursing glasses of the local red wine. They sat at one of the other tables outside. There was a greeting from the table of locals, who had smiled at the sight of two women on a motorbike, and smiled even more when they saw their age. This would be talked about for days, analysed and speculated upon in a village where nothing ever happened other than the arrival of passers-by. The proprietor brought them a large bottle of carbonated water. They sipped on this while they scrutinised the menu, which offered them what it described as the particular delights of the region. Ilse said,
"Well, I feel we're really on our way now. Home seems a long way away."
"It does," said Val,
"and it is,
with all its cares."
"Yes, with all its cares. Your wall of death, it's in good hands, isn't it?"
"Those two young men are completely reliable," said Ilse. "They're never happier than when they're going round and round, making the girls scream with delight. All our young men have been the same."
Val laughed.
"What girl wouldn't like to see a young man going round and round a wall of death?"
She paused.
"Did you ever go on it yourself?"
Ilse nodded.
"I used to, now and then. I rode one of the smaller bikes. I sometimes went on when Ubi was riding. He enjoyed it. He was never really happy running the inn, but when we gave that up to concentrate on the motodrome, he was very happy."
Val lifted her glass of water to her mouth. The bubbles were sharp on the tongue, tiny needles of sensation.
"You must miss him," she said.
Ilse looked back at her.
"Yes, just as you must miss Mike."
"When you marry again," said Val, "you don't talk about that too much. You're meant to be over it,
But you aren't, you know. Not really. We have our boys, of course.
Yes, said Val.
And Tommy's a good son. Now that he's working in London, I don't see so much of him. And he's got his own young family now. You're Klaus. Do you see a lot of him?
It's not too far to Stuttgart, said Ilse.
3 hours or so. He's doing well. He's never liked motorbikes since he fell off one when he was just a boy. He loves cars, which is why he's working for those people in Stuttgart. But motorbikes, no. He disapproves of my riding, you realize?
Val smiled.
I think it shows we brought them up right if they disapprove of our behavior.
Perhaps. No, you're right. You're right.
The proprietor came to take their order.
You've ridden down here all of the way from Germany? He asked.
We have, answered Ilse. And we are going on to Naples, then Sicily, Palermo.
The proprietor suppressed a smile.
You could join us if you like, said Val.
Do you have a motorbike?
The proprietor laughed.
I have a wife, he said.
Ilse made a gesture of disappointment.
Oh, well.
They were brought their food. Afterwards, with coffee on the table, they sat under the shade of the umbrella and looked down onto the plains.
You know, said Val, there was something I was told that I don't think I ever passed on to you.
Oh?
Yes. Mike told me. He said that when they were in Holland, when they were hiding from...
She stopped herself.
From the Germans,
Ilse supplied.
Yes, but it was a long time ago. Let's say different Germans.
Something happened?
Yes. They had a dog with them.
I heard about that, said Ilse.
And your husband, your Ubi, was ordered to shoot the dog.
Ilse winced.
But he did not, continued Val. He saved the dog's life by firing a shot in the air.
Ilse was silent.
He did that?
She asked at last.
Yes, said Val.
Ilse looked down at the tablecloth.
I'm glad you told me that, she said. I'm very glad.
You never knew it?
No, but I'm grateful you told me, because it makes me proud of him.
They were both silent. Then Ilse said,
Do you think it's possible to love somebody who isn't there any longer? To carry on loving him?
Val looked up at the sky. A hint of a cooling breeze had sprung up, and it touched her now. Swallows dipped and swooped in pursuit of prey in the higher layers of air, tiny dots of pirouetting black. The question was not a casual one, she thought. This was as important as anything they had said to one another.
Of course it is, she said. Of course.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I'm quite sure.
And then she added,
Look up there. Look at the birds.
What about them?
Nothing.
She thought,
You can go on loving people a long time after they have left you. You can love them every bit as much as you loved them when they were still here. Love lasts. Love grows stronger. Love lasts a lifetime. And beyond.
The End. This is David Rintoul. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Good Pilot Peter Woodhouse by Alexander McCall Smith. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.